Hello everyone and welcome back to the Forgecast. My name's Sam Towns and I will be your solo host for this week's episode. But before we get to that, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor. And this week's episode is firing your ear forges thanks to the wonderful people at Nordic Edge, purveyors of all things knife making, including grinder belts, file guides, steel, and everything else your heart can desire. So stop by nordicedge.com.au right now and stock up. So here we are yet again with another solo episode. I apologize in advance if I clear my throat a lot. I am recovering from a cold. But this time it wasn't a scheduling issue. This time it was a technological issue. We recorded an episode, actually, the night before I'm recording this, and the technology deleted half of the audio. So I am recording this last minute or thereabouts. So, with that being said, what have I been up to this week? For those of you who follow me on Instagram, you'll know that I've been doing a lot of reworking on HEMA stuff. I recently just did a regrind on a Krieger Armory longsword, which the customer had decided wanted to be turned into a sharp for doing test cuts and stuff like that. And so I reground that. It was a very interesting, very challenging job because I had to regrind it with the handle on it, which if any of you have done regrinds on any kind of knife or sword with the handle still attached, it's a massive pain in the butt. And the main reason I had to do that is because the construction was peened, and basically they didn't want me to take the whole thing apart in order to regrind it, and that also would create a whole lot more work than just regrinding it with the handle on. So yeah, instead I regrind it with the handle on and polished it up, and it's pretty dang sharp. Now, it was originally created as a HEMA blade, so it is a little bit floppier than a standard sharp longsword would be, but I managed to keep as much of the rigidity as I possibly could. And that meant that we ended up with a pretty functional cutting blade for all that. In other news, I've just moved in a new housemate, so they're now fully moved in, and that's taken up a lot of my time, but unfortunately they brought the plague with them, fortunately not COVID. I retested and retested myself a number of times to make sure that it wasn't the nasty coof. Instead, it's just the flu, but I've been struck pretty badly with it, so I've been slowly recovering. But I did manage to get a little bit of other work done. I've been slowly working back through that batch of blades that I talked about in previous episodes, and I've now got two Sax blades ready for hand sanding and treating. They're both heat treated. They've just got to, I'm going to stonewash one of them, and the other one I'm not sure what I'm going to do with yet. It's been an interesting couple. Like, it's been an interesting week with all of the ups and downs of moving stuff into the house and being sick and all that kind of stuff. So it's been hectic, been very hectic, but productive, hopefully. For those of you wanting to catch up with Zach, obviously go over and check him out on Instagram and stuff like that. He has been flat out. He just started doing classes, which you may have seen on my stories as well. And he had his first class last week with a father and son duo. Looked like it went really well. And I'm really happy to see him finally, kind of spanning out and actually teaching some classes, which is great to see. And I hope to see more of it in the future. I might even get back to doing classes one day. But for now, I'm happy to see more people in Perth offering classes for beginner blacksmiths. So if you're in Perth and you want to do a class with Zach, feel free to go contact him over at Laughing Fish Forge. I'm sure he'd be happy for more students. My song of the week this week is actually a song that I picked up from You Know Where, and it went viral a number of months ago, I think, and it had kind of been on the edge of my radar because the whole meaning behind the song really vibes with me. I'm a very big fan of lyrical songs. Like I either connect with the lyrics or I want a song that doesn't have lyrics, basically. And lyrically, this song is quite meaningful to me. It's about anxiety and, like the idea of being chronically cautious, and that's the title of the song, is Chronically Cautious. And it's Braden Bales. It's a fantastic song. The beat's really great. I love the overall song, and just the feel of it. But also lyrically, it very much, you know, jives with how I feel most days. You know, waking up and not sure whether or not you wanna do this, the whole thing, because it seems like a whole big risk. But yeah, definitely well worth a listen to if you haven't already. And yeah, hopefully you enjoy. Given that it's just me here today, I figure I'll get right into the inspirations and get them out of the way. And my inspiration of the week this week is actually someone that I'm not sure if I've used as an inspiration before. I have this sneaking suspicion that they have been on my radar for a very long time, but for some reason I wasn't following them on Instagram. And their work is very evocative of another maker that I do know has been used as an inspiration and is someone that I follow quite closely. This maker specifically made a set of pliers, and these were forged to finish, and then they were filed to beautiful, beautiful crisp lines. And originally I was just looking at them and there's a nice pair of pliers, but then I realized that they are boxed Boss pliers. So they've been, it's a split Boss, split down the middle, and then one of the halves of the plier has actually been fed through the other half of the plier before they've then been pinned. So it's almost like a hinge Boss rather than two Bosses laid on top of each other like we would with tongs. And that just blew my mind because it's so crisp. It's so well fit up. And getting that crisp and clean of a fit up with everything matching and all of the flats being aligned with each other is so unbelievably hard to do properly, that it absolutely blew my mind, and I spent a good half hour staring at it. But then I also went and checked out the rest of his Instagram page, which there aren't that many photos on there, but the ones that are, he's done some spectacular work around forged hinged stuff and forged tools. So he did a pair of forged calipers that he did some sterling silver inlay into, and he also did a framed hacksaw, forged frame hacksaw, which looks absolutely amazing, and I really want one. His name on Instagram is Nate_Weiss_, and that is Weiss, or is it 1S? I think it's 1S. So Nate_Weiss_, and he does some spectacular work. So go and check him out. He's chronically underfollowed on Insta, so make sure to let him know that the Forgecast sent him. And so with inspirations out of the way, or inspiration in this case, we can move straight into some listener emails, and we have quite a few. So let's get to that. And this week, our listener email segments comes to you thanks to Knife Maker Plus, where you can get taught the pro tips of bladesmithing by one of the best in the world, ABS Mastersmith Kyle Royer. It's like he's right there in the room instructing you. So turn your knife making game all the way up to 11 by visiting learnknifemaking.com after the show. And our first email comes from Garrett Navarrete, who says, "Hello, I have two questions for you. First, could you talk a little bit about why the tempering temps for 1045 steel are always so hot? When I look for charts to decide what tempering temp to use, they start out at around 700 degrees Fahrenheit, or 371 degrees Celsius. That seems crazy hot for how low such a low carbon steel. I'm making a pocket clip out of 1045 to give you an idea of what tempering temp I'm looking for. Second, is the forge scale on all stainless still stainless? If I wanted to make a ring from, let's say, 304 stainless and give it a forge scale finish, would it rust on my hand? Sorry for the long questions. Thank you in advance." And thank you very much, Garrett, for sending that in. And great questions. I love these kinds of questions, especially very specific steel questions. Love it. Now, as to 1045, the reason that a lot of tempering temperatures are listed for 1045 in really high ranges is kind of twofold. The first reason, and it's the same reason for every steel out there, whenever you go into like a heat treating app or you go on to any kind of heat treating chart, you're going to end up with the industrial heat treating temperatures. So when they're talking about heat treating 1045 in most of the charts, they're talking about heat treating vehicle chassis or axles or very large cross sections of material, which require higher toughness than hardness. They're not looking for workability at that point. They're not looking for retaining the face of a hammer or anything like that. They're literally just looking for the ability to withstand lots of torque or lots of torsion in the case of vehicle chassis. So when I make my hammers, and I make my hammers out of 1045, I use a temperature of about 200 to 250 degrees Celsius, which is perfect for what you're trying to do with a hammer. I've found it's not too soft, but it's also not stupid hard that it's going to start fracturing out and stuff like that. For a pocket clip, on the other hand, as high as your oven goes, normally most ovens go to about 250 degrees Celsius, is going to be perfect for that kind of thing, because you're not looking for a lot of hardness in that case. You're only looking for that elasticity, that springiness that you would get out of 1045. Realistically, you could probably get away with not heat treating it and still get the springiness you need out of a pocket clip. In my case, I've done pocket clips out of copper. I've done pocket clips out of mild steel. Either way, you're going to end up with a decent pocket clip. It doesn't really need to be that high grade. On to your second question, the stainless like question around whether or not stainless scale is stainless is kind of a yes and no thing, because the scale itself is obviously stainless because scale doesn't oxidize, because scale is an oxide. But in the realm of stainless scale on stainless steel, it kind of falls into the category of how much scale is there. Because when stainless scales, unlike iron and mild steel and steel, where the scale is mostly just ferrous oxide, so it is Fe304, in the case of stainless scale, there's a lot of chromium in there. Because chromium leaches into the scale rather than into the air like carbon does when you're oxidizing steel. So in the case of stainless steel, if you're forging your stainless and getting it hot and keeping it hot for long periods of time, that chromium can leach out, and then that means that the surface of your steel, the surface of your stainless, can become non-stainless. It can become standard steel, basically, and end up rusting like a normal steel would. The other thing that stainless scale does, and it's like all scale, is it creates a porosity in the face of the piece, right? It creates a porosity on the surface of the metal, which can then trap moisture, which can then cause more corrosion. In 304 stainless is a fairly high chromium stainless. It is a non-martensitic stainless. It doesn't make knives or anything like that, as you're probably aware. I believe it is idealized as a maritime stainless. It's normally used in boat construction and bolts and stuff like that. So you're more than likely looking at getting fairly high chromium content in your scale. And that means that it's going to pop off really easy. It's going to, when you cool down a piece of stainless that's been heated in the forge, the scale crackles and pings off really fast because the scale contracts so quickly. And that's due to that extra alloying content. But as far as like making a ring and doing that, you're still going to want to get all of the loose scale off. I would highly suggest pickling it in some like hydrochloric acid or something like that. And then if you want to get that dark black as forged look, there are available chemicals that will be able to oxidize that stainless. I believe Birchwood Casey makes some. I can't remember off the top of my head what they're called, but there are specifically stainless cold bluing solutions, and that would be my route if I wanted to make some stainless, black stainless gear, rather than trying to get it black and as forged look on just the material itself. And the reason for that is because you want to get rid of any of that thin layer of non-chromium steel at the surface of your stainless that you've forged into a ring. But hopefully you'll send us some photos of your forged rings when you're done, and I'm really interested to see them. So don't let me dissuade you from trying. It's definitely something that can be done. It just takes a little bit of care. But thank you very much for the question. And our second question comes from Easy Beasy Lemon Squeezy, which I love that name. It's absolutely amazing. Flows off the tongue really well. And Easy says, many, many thanks for the podcast and all of the information and guidance you all have offered, as well as the continued inspiration you all provide. I'm an extremely new blacksmith and have been working on building my own solid fuel forge. It's just a simple brake drum forge, but I've needed to make some new improvements due to the obvious limitations that brings. I wanted to ask your opinions on the overall construction. I'm mainly worried about the refractory cement used in the fire pot, as I've never worked with it before. I've included pictures as well with my Instagram page, which is at bz_lemon. You should go give him a follow. Which I've been used to document my blacksmithing journey. Any suggestions you would have would be greatly appreciated. Overall, it's just a brake drum with 3-inch angle iron welded to the top at a 1/4-inch grate, refractory cement fire pot, and my airflow is provided by a box bellows. Now, first off, I love that you used box bellows. As everyone knows, I am somewhat of a tiny weeaboo. As Alex would say, I am a weeb. And so to see a Fuego box bellows being used is always fun times for me. I really want to make one of my own one day and make a full, you know, Tatara and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so as far as your construction goes, the listeners won't be able to see it, but I can see the photos here. I understand that you're using a castable fire brick. Now, obviously, I'm not familiar with this specific mix. I'm not sure if you're from Australia or from America. I'm guessing America because I've never seen this product specifically around, but if it's a castable fire brick, then it's not castable mortar. And the big thing, like, you want to use castable rather than mortar. In Australia, one of the most easy access that we have to, quote unquote, heat proof, concrete or mortar is, Lanco 156, which is a fireproof cement used for making like fire ovens, like pizza ovens and stuff like that. And the problem is that it's just not rated to the kind of temperatures that a forge will uphold. And what normally ends up happening is it ends up powdering when it gets too hot and then it melts. And so I don't think that that's what's going to happen with yours, although do check the temperature rating. Most refractories will have a temperature rating in either Celsius or Fahrenheit. Sometimes it's in the name. But otherwise, yeah, castable fire brick's probably going to be a dense castable refractory or medium density castable refractory. So you probably are safe. That being said, you're using a brake drum forge, with a bottom blast, and honestly, you don't need refractory in it. I know that Alex and I have both used refractory in our, pot forges. And that's because we use it to fill up the corners, because both of us have square box forges, and those square boxes, those corners don't get hot, like the coals don't light up. So instead we fill that area with refractory so as not to have excess coal just taking up space and wasting that coal, essentially. So instead we end up with a usable conical shaped fire pot, which, you know, if you can make that with just steel, you can get away with it. A lot of the old like cavalry forges and stuff like that were literally just an open pan. They were basically just a flat plate, and you would just pile the coals on top. One of my favorite forges that I used to build, I've built two of them, was literally a plow disc, and the plow disc just had a pipe fed in from the side, and that was my whole forge, and that worked brilliantly. I loved those forges. So whatever you use, your main endeavor is to not make too deep of a charcoal pit, because obviously if you're using charcoal or coal, you don't want to be putting your work down into it. You want to be putting it across the fire pot, which, you know, it seems you've made cutouts in your rim, which is great so that you can feed through long poles and stuff like that. But yeah, on the overall, a brake drum is going to be able to withstand the heat pretty easily, and the tweer is actually not where most of the heat is allocated, because the air and the heat is all rising. So as far as I'm concerned, the whole build looks great. I think you're going to get real well, getting along real well with that. And I really look forward to seeing what you come up with. I'm going to have to throw you a follow on Instagram and keep up to date with what you get up to. Thanks very much for messaging into the show, and have fun. And our last question comes from Keith. Good old Keza. And he says, "Hey guys, got a question for you both." Well, unfortunately, it's just me, Keith. What I would like to do as part of my business plan is to get a large shop and have it be set up like a co-op. Everyone would pay a monthly due to rent out a workspace, and then they would have access to tools like power hammers, press, etc. I figured this would be good for people who live in a residential area or who cannot afford all of the equipment. We recently moved about a year ago, and I am still kind of new to the area. How would you recommend me trying to find out about whether this is something people would be interested in, and what advice could you give for and against this idea? Thank you very much, Keza. Cheers, Keith. And it's a fantastic question and a fantastic idea. It is definitely something that's come across the desk of both Zach and myself, and I wish he was here to help answer this question, but we did actually go over this in the previous recording, so I know of some of what he would have said. So the key thing that comes to mind for me is that with any main building where you're going to have a lot of people coming through and machinery and tooling and all that kind of stuff is insurance. That is going to be your key problem. Now, I'm not sure about what the situation is in the States as far as insurance companies. I know in Australia we have an issue where there isn't really insurance companies making a product for blacksmiths or for people in our line of work. And so we have to kind of either work with an insurance company to try and make something custom for us, or we go the route of utilizing the insurance of a larger corporation. Like, for instance, when I do my classes, I am covered by the Australian Knife Makers Guild insurance. So something that you might want to think about is contacting something like ABANA, the Artisan Blacksmiths of North America, and seeing if they have an insurance policy or see if they have a program for that kind of thing that would help you. They also might be able to facilitate you procuring that space. If you were interested in creating a space that was then able to host classes for something like that, I think that would be a really good way to go. Because the other issue is cost. You know, a space is not exactly cheap, and then the tooling, like power hammers, like presses, that kind of thing, is incredibly expensive, especially if you're running it in a space that is going to be accessed to the public and by paid membership. Because the thing is, you've got to remember, like, running stuff in your own shop, you can kind of get away with having jankily put together rickety stuff. But the moment that you start having access to the general public and you have to justify it to your insurers, then you have to have everything credited. You have to have everything wired up by electricians. You have to have everything tested and tagged. All of your gas fittings for your forges have to be signed off by a gas fitter, all that kind of stuff. It becomes a massive pain in the ass and a massive pile of red tape. We have friends here in Australia who run a co-op kind of space where they do classes, and they have a shared space for tooling and stuff like that, and they've recently purchased power hammers and stuff like that. So we've had a little bit of the insight into the background of that kind of thing, and it literally takes up 90% of your not working time. And the bigger the space becomes, the more of a headache it becomes in as far as that goes. And the less time you have as a maker yourself. Now, the reason that I would never go down this route, specifically me, is the fact that I want to be a maker more than I want to be the curator of a space. And the moment you have paid memberships, the moment you have lots of people coming in and out, the moment you have that kind of coordination to do, unless you're willing to get together with like a committee and like actually set up president and vice president and secretary and treasurer and all that kind of stuff and have those people on board to take on those missions, you are going to have to do that on your own. And in the end, that is going to wear you out really easy, unless you dedicate most of your time to it, which means that you dedicate less of your time to actually making stuff. Now, if that's something you want to do, if you want to curate that space, if you want to create that space for people, if you want to do that, please do. And I think it's a fantastic idea. But yeah, just be aware that it is a lot of legal red tape and a lot of effort to go through. So make sure that you're ready for that when you go for it. In the other circumstance, like as far as like how to get people interested, Facebook groups, Instagram, all that kind of stuff. If you are just contacting people in your local community, go to your local car boot sales, set up a stall as a blacksmith and do your local Ren fair and stuff like that. And talk to people, ask them straight face to face. If you're not confident in doing that, maybe put out an ad in the local paper. I know not a lot of people read those anymore, but you know there'll be a few that'll read it. Those kinds of things will get you noticed. And you can also put posts out in your local Facebook groups. There are normally Facebook groups for your local area for like keep watch out and all that kind of stuff, but they're also used for advertising local events, and you could put an advertisement out there just going, hey guys, anyone interested in having a blacksmith's workshop set up in town that you guys can use? So don't be afraid to utilize as much as you can of the social media aspect, because that's probably going to be your best bet for contacting the largest group of people. But hopefully you can get some money together behind you in order to purchase the space and all that kind of stuff. Maybe you're in a place where you can just purchase that space outside outright, and that would be great. But if not, that's going to be your key concern at the beginning, and then making sure that you've got your insurances and all that kind of stuff up to date, and then working out how much you're going to have to charge each person for membership in at a minimum so that you can actually make overheads. So, yeah, best of luck with it, Keith. I hope that you actually go ahead with it if you really want to, and I really look forward to hearing how that all works out. Yeah, hopefully I haven't turned you off the idea. I know it sounds like I'm really against the idea, but I'm not. I'm not going to do it. But those who want to do it, hats off to you. I love that idea. So yeah, thank you very much. So with emails out of the way, that brings us in to Technique of the Week.
Technique of the Week.
And this week's technique is something that is also very close to my heart, and that is filing. It is something that I think we've talked about on the show before, and we might have talked about it more than once, because files and filing are something that I live for. I'm absolutely passionate about filing, and anyone who follows me knows that I love my files and will collect as many files as I can, both to turn into knives when they're too dull to use as files, or to file things, and I love my drawer of files that I've got. But filing is one of those things that I think most of us either take for granted or we don't put a lot of energy into learning how to do properly. And one of the common misconceptions I see, I suppose, is this idea that when you're filing, you have to have it locked in a vise. Now, I made a couple of videos on making gravers, specifically Japanese-style tagane gravers, that I use a hand vise, and I, you know, freehand basically file everything. And I've actually got a couple of comments on those YouTube videos of making the gravers asking why I don't just lock it in a vise, like a normal bench vise. And the reason for it is because it's actually more controllable to have both the work in one hand and the file in the other, rather than having two hands on the file. And the reason for that is because when you're working very small stock, and especially when you're working very specific angles, having it locked in the vise actually makes it more difficult to control than it does having it in either hand. The other thing is I can change angles really easily by rotating my hand, whereas I can't do that if it's locked in the vise. I kind of have to constantly be unlocking the vise, relocking the vise. So if you're going to be filing small pieces, I highly suggest buying a hand vise. And you can buy hand vises from Amazon for like $50. Sometimes you'll get them even cheaper. And they are an insanely useful bit of kit if you're going to be working on small stuff. Like whenever I'm doing inlay work and stuff like that, I cut my inlay out with a jeweler's saw, and then I use needle files and the hand vise to hold the little piece and actually file out all of the little details before I then go to inlay that piece into my work. So making sure that you have a good way to hold your piece is going to be the first key to filing properly. If your vise is wobbling around all the place, all over the place, or if it's not holding things securely, like if your vise jaws are cranked so that they pinch on one side and not the other, that's going to make your filing harder. And the best way you can tell is by listening. If the file is cutting well, then it will sound like a dull grate. It will just be, you know, it'll be that dull, smooth scrape. If it's high-pitched or keening, then it's either that the piece is not being supported properly, so it's not being clamped properly or not being placed on your jeweler's peg properly, or it is too hard. It is being hardened past the point where the file can cut it. And when I'm filing gravers, that tends to happen a lot because I end up not supporting the piece properly because I have the end of the graver hanging out over the air, and that causes that grating. The other thing that causes grating, obviously, is filing across a piece when it's quite thin and narrow, and that means that it ends up vibrating like a tuning fork and making that high-pitched squeal. Now, we all know that filing only happens in one direction. File teeth only cut on the push stroke. That's been covered in a million videos and stuff like that. Jason at Fireball Tools did a great video about whether or not you can push and pull a file. And I think that that's a great video, and I think that's a great experiment onto whether or not it actually has an effect. And he found that it really didn't affect too much the overall effect on the file, but I prefer to cut only on the push stroke, and the main reason for that is because I find it more controllable and less noisy. But you can push and pull. Anyone who tells you otherwise is obviously never watched the Fireball Tool video. Now, that being said, when cutting on the push stroke, you don't want to be pushing straight with the file. Like, if the sides of the file are your straight line, if you're pushing parallel to those, then you are actually going to be clogging your teeth faster than if you cut at a slight angle. So if you imagine pushing your file forward with those parallel lines, but then sideways at the same time, so that you're creating like a 45 degree angle while keeping the file straight, you'll actually be better engaging the teeth, because if you look at the file teeth, they're actually cut at an angle on the file face, and so it actually makes those teeth engage better and roll those chips off. Now, obviously, chips are always going to get stuck. Doesn't matter what file you use, what kind of file you should decide to take, you're going to end up with pinning. You're going to end up with chips getting stuck under the teeth. And there are multiple ways to get rid of them. The main one being, of course, a file card. And everyone should have one. Everyone should buy a file card. If you don't have one, go buy one. They're not expensive. You can find them on eBay. You can find them on Amazon. You can find them at your local hardware store. They are a fantastic piece of kit. If you don't have one, then a brass brush will do. The other one that I use a lot is a piece of copper or brass sharpened to a chisel. And what I do is actually run them along the teeth. So instead of like with or against the teeth, we're running them along the teeth, like along the grain of the tooth. And the file will actually cut little grooves into the end of your brass or copper chisel, and those grooves will actually create teeth that run down inside the gullet of the chisel and actually pick out those little pins. And those are really good for those really stubborn pins and stuff like that, especially on bastard files and really heavy cut files that you normally can't clear otherwise. So yeah, just get yourself a piece of copper, either mash it down with a hammer into a chisel shape or grind it into a chisel shape, and you can use that to scrape your file teeth out. The other thing that obviously a lot of old-timers will tell you is chalk your files. If you just use some old school chalk, some chalkboard chalk, and you just rub a very light coating on your files, make sure that you're not oiling your files, make sure your files are nice and dry and clean, then if you chalk them, that chalk will then slightly clog the pores of the file, but what that does is then it prevents the pins from holding up in those gullets. It ends up causing those pins to fall free rather than sticking under the teeth. So I chalk most of my files when I'm working because I really hate stopping to free stuck pins, because I'm trying to like get really nice clean finishes in my filing, and pinning in a file always creates really jagged, rough galling, and that can look really unattractive. Properly done file finishes can look absolutely amazing. Just my inspiration of the week, Nate Weiss, has perfect examples of that, and Seth Gould, who is also an amazing maker who makes some great forged gear, does amazing filed finishes. And for me, a good filed finish is in some ways superior to a good ground finish. Any kind of mechanically ground finish is going to look, you know, inferior in my perspective to a well-done hand-filed finish, because well-done hand-filed finishes take a little bit of practice and a little bit of patience. When selecting your files, make sure that you're selecting a good brand. Don't buy cheap shit files unless you're going to beat the crap out of them and not care. Like I've got beta files that I use for like hardness testing and stuff, but I don't use those when I'm doing my good file work. I tend to use better quality files. So the list of those is Third is one of my favorites. Nicholson makes some really good files, especially if you can get old stock. The Nicholson Magicut files are actually kind of among my favorites. Barco make decent files. If you can find Barco files, they're actually pretty good. And then obviously at the top, which I wish I could afford are Valorb or Grobay files, Swiss-made Grobay files. My dream one day is to own an entire set of Grobay needle files and Grobay hand files, but it'll probably never happen because I'd have to mortgage a house that I don't own. So I will stick with Third for now. Third preferred in this house. But yeah, between my whole collection is mostly Nicholson Magicut for my heavy duty cutting, and then Third for my medium cuts. And then I have a couple of Barco light cuts in there as well as some Nicholson old stock hand smooth files, which you can't really get very often anymore. And smooth cut files leave like a 400 grit finish from a file, which is amazing. I love it because it means that I can go straight to hand sanding from a file if I really want to. And I know not everyone does, but, you know, that's just my opinion. Files are awesome. But, yeah, so when you're filing, make sure that your file selection is good. Make sure you have a selection of cuts. So you want a double cut bastard. I don't bother with mill cut bastards. Now, the difference between double and mill cut is obviously a double cut has been cut. The teeth have been cut one way, and then they've been recut in a second way, so they create that diamond cross section, and ostensibly that is to increase the cutting performance of the teeth because it lowers the surface area of the tooth, but it also decreases the chances of pinning somewhat. I don't really think that it makes that much of a difference. Mill cut files, on the other hand, once you get down below second cut, so you're going to third and fourth cuts, those hand smooth files that I was talking about, mill cut's pretty much the only way to go. So what I'll normally do is I'll have a double cut bastard, I'll have a double cut second cut file, and then I will go to a mill hand smooth file. And that those three grades of file will get me through pretty much any filing that I want to do. But I know now that you probably are sick of me saying the word file, so we should move into the topic. And just because I am a little bit of a troll, I will mention files at the beginning of the topic, because this week's topic is historical sword making, specifically around the industrial period. Now, we've had several collective questions about sword making in the history and all that kind of stuff. People know that it is something that I am incredibly passionate about. And historical sword making and historical industrial blacksmithing is something that I want to dive into more on this show. And there are definitely people that I have in mind that I want to bring onto the show to talk about this specific kind of thing. But I figured today I would just spend a little bit of time ranting about one of my favorite periods in time, which was the Napoleonic period or the Georgian era of Britain, and the introduction of mass production of military arms. Now, for those of you who don't know, the first pattern of military sword ever created in Britain was in 1788, and it was fairly loose weave. The first pattern sword was the heavy cavalry sword, the 1788 pattern heavy cavalry sword, and it didn't actually see that much widespread use, because in 1796, the new patents came out, and the new patents came out with new patterns. And those patterns had patterns for every sword. So instead of just this one specific sword, so that was the only pattern sword that existed at the time, the 1788, which is actually a really awesome sword, you should have a look, because it's a basket-hilted back sword. But anyway, the 1796 patents came out with Jean-Gaspard Le Marchand designing the 1796 light cavalry saber, which is one of the most famous sabers of the historical period of that time and of British swords in general. And his design of the 1796 light cavalry saber actually influenced the design of pretty much every other saber in use during that period from the British side, and in some cases the French, and especially the Prussians. But we'll get to that in a minute. So the 1796 light cavalry saber was a single-edged, heavily curved, single knuckle-bowed, guarded, you know, sword that was specifically designed for use atop a horse. And one of the things that Le Marchand wanted to specialize it for was cutting rather than thrusting, because he believed that a cut from horseback was safer than thrusting, because if your sword gets stuck in the opponent when you're riding past them, you could break your shoulder trying to remove the sword. But anyway, what this introduction of this sword did was introduce patterning for makers. Now, before that period, basically, if you wanted a sword as a British officer, you would go to a sword maker and you would just ask for a sword to be made, and you would give your specifications, and then the sword maker would make it. And there were several sword makers at the time, Osborne and Gunby. There were various Sheffield makers that were making that kind of stuff, and Wilkinson was quite popular at the time as well, and became one of the biggest sword makers of the, you know, 19th century. When the patterns came in, you ended up with universal swords for all men afoot and men on men on horseback, both trooper and officer. And that was the first time it had ever been implemented in British military history and in most military history, because before that, swords were either hand-me-down issued stuff or they were generic stuff that wasn't really made to a pattern, but it was all similar. So for instance, most cavalry troopers and officers would get a similar kind of sword, unless you're a fairly rich officer, in which case you would supply your own sword made by a maker. And then 1788 cavalry officers and cavalry trooper sword was patented and patented, and so therefore sword makers then had a design that they had to work from. And in 1796, this became standard for all infantry and all cavalry and all navy. And this saw the implementation of size standards and overall, you know, balance standards and stuff like that, which makers then had to implement. And this was kind of the very beginning of the industrial era. So you started seeing mass production of sword blades. And that's what the patent really helped, was that it ended up designing the machines that would then go on to produce England's swords for the rest of eternity as drop forges and stuff like that. So instead of having individual makers hammering out blades, you would then start to see more implementation of drop forging and machining into the workspace. So with the patent came a lot of industrial revolution. It came with a lot of industrial expansion. Rather than leaning on the maker, the craftsman, you now were leaning on machines. And some people saw this as kind of a disadvantage to the British military, but it also quickly became evident that it was an advantage for arming such large swathes of men, and it also made it easier to train people how to use swords, because if you're all using the same, basically the same weight, the same size of sword, it's a lot easier to tell everyone how to use it than if you've got seven guys with seven different sizes and shapes of sword. It becomes very difficult to train them how to use it. The only sidebar to that, sorry, I just knocked a sax off my table, was that officers could kind of customize their swords within the pattern. So, for instance, the 1796 light cavalry saber was specifically had to be between 32 and 34 inches long, and it had to have a curve of no less than, I believe it was a 10 centimeter curve, which is, if the tip and hilt are braced against a single flat edge, then the distance between the spine and the flat edge had to be around that. It was 5 centimeters. 10 centimeters was like the maximum. But officers could play within those realms. So if they wanted a slightly longer sword, they could get a 34-inch sword, or if they wanted slightly shorter, and if they wanted slightly more curved or slightly less curved, they could have that customized. But these patterns were specifically for sword makers making troopers' swords, so that they would all come out pretty much the same, and everyone would look uniform, which was very important to the British military at the time. As everyone knows, the redcoats, they all wanted to look very similar in appearance. But the patterning process in the makers' sphere was really interesting, because makers like Osborne and Gunby, who designed their own pattern of 1796 light cavalry saber, which is, to my opinion, actually the better design than the one that they took from Jean-Gaspard Le Marchand, The Osborne and Gunsby design was originally patented by Osborne and Gunsby and they made a very small batch of them, and then they never made any more. And those were all craftsman made rather than machine made or rather than industrialized. And during this period, like I said, industry was only starting to become a thing. So a lot of these swords, although they were patented and patented in a way that was supposed to be the same all the time and industrialization was happening, a lot of the makersphere, including Wilkinson Sword and that kind of stuff, had to hire craftsmen to try and recreate these swords exactly identical every time. And it became a serious issue for production. Now, something that a lot of people don't talk about in the production of historical swords, especially in this period, is that we had just come past the period, or Britain had just come past the period of the using the cementation process and making shear steel. And shear steel was still the key production component of most usable steel. So the crucible particle process and all that kind of stuff wasn't really in use yet. We weren't seeing a lot of homogenized steel. And it was only really towards the end of the Napoleonic War, around 1812, 1814, that they really started to utilize that kind of thing. But shear steel was still being used all the way up until the 1900s. So when you were constructing these swords, you weren't constructing them all out of one piece. In a lot of cases, they didn't trust the shear strength of shear steel. So funnily enough, so the blades would be shear steel, but they would actually forge weld their tang and ricasso out of wrought iron. So a lot of early production models of 1796, like cavalry saber, 1788 heavy cavalry saber, a lot of the sabers from that period, if you were to etch them, you would actually see a cleft weld. So what they would do is cleave a piece of wrought iron in half down the middle, and then they would put the wedge, the sword blade in there, and actually cleft the wrought iron on the outside, clad it round, and then forge weld that down. And that was to create that soft transition from hard blade down to soft tang, so that the tang could then be entered into the handle and all that kind of stuff. And that actually increased the speed of production, because basically you could have a bladesmith who forged the blade, forged the tang, like forge welded the tang on all that kind of stuff, forged out the overall component, and then they would heat treat them. They would just heat the whole lot, dunk it, and then send it off to the cutler, after a tempering, obviously. And the cutler would do all the grinding post-heat treat and the fitment of the pieces. The cutler would do a lot of the fitting of the components, because remember, this is industrialized production at this point. There's like 7 people who work on any one sword. The polisher would do the polishing, and then the cutler would come to fit the components, and they could file on the tang and file on the tang shoulders, because it was all wrought iron. They didn't have to worry about it themselves working on hardened steel. And this also increased the lifespan of the fittings, which is really important, because a lot of, especially officers' swords, the fittings would end up being reused on later blades. There are examples of, 1845 and 1860 pattern blades on much earlier fittings, because the fittings were protected by the fact that the tangs were wrought iron, and so the hardened steel wasn't digging into the face of, say, the brass or the wrought iron bodies of the fittings, the guards. So it was kind of multifaceted. I don't think that was the original intention. I think it was mostly just to stop it from breaking at the tang. And that's something that it was very good at. A lot of evidence and a lot of historical accounts from the Napoleonic period and later, and obviously a lot of the recovered swords from combat that we've got from those periods, the majority of broken blades are broken in the center of the blade, so broken down towards the center of percussion where you would have been hitting with the sword anyway. And the reason for that is because, A, that's where the sword was at its thinnest, but B, because it was also where the hardened steel was. The tang was not a weak point because, A, it was normally around 8 to 10 millimeters thick at the tang, and B, it was made of wrought iron, so it didn't break, it just bent. And this is another reason why they ended up with such thick cross sections at the hilt. I say 8 to 10 millimeters. That's quite hefty. That's 3/8 of an inch for my American listeners. And the reason for that is because they didn't want it to bend at that point. They wanted the majority of the weight towards the hand, and they wanted it to be strong in that it wasn't hardened. It would flex easier at the same cross section. So therefore, having it thicker meant that it wasn't going to bend at all. And so therefore, they could afford to have soft material there. And this is the other part of forging those swords of those periods that was so important, because you weren't able to just grind it out of a bar of steel because you had compound distal taper. And compound distal taper is something I've spoken about on my YouTube channel, which is a taper that's not just a straight line from the thickness at the ricasso to the thickness at the tip. It is instead a thickness at the ricasso that tapers over 3 inches or 4 inches, or about, you know, 100 millimeters, down to another thickness. So you go from, say, 8 millimeters down to 4 millimeters, and then it's a straight line from the 4 millimeters down to the 1.2 millimeters it was at the tip, which in the case of the 1796 light cavalry saber was about that. It was about 1 millimeter thick at the tip, but it was very wide. And so having to forge these, you definitely couldn't get away with grinding these because it would be a massive waste of materials. So instead, having to forge these, you had to make sure that your guys were really close on their overall patterning when it came to selecting steel sizes. So that became another issue of having to standardize the sizes of steel bar that they were using in order to create these swords. And actually, this is something that you see in a lot of the historical records, is that they now have they then had standardized sizes from the steel mills of the bars that they were supposed to create in order to go to the sword makers and the knife makers of the time. And that's passed on even in modern history. As far as I'm aware, we are still using some of the sizes of bar that were being used back in that early industrial period to serve the patterning process of the period that they were trying to, you know, industrialize the creation of things like swords. So this all had a knock-on effect, this idea of standardization and uniformization of the military, had a massive knock-on effect to the overall industrial era and to our modern lives. So this is why I get so passionate about this kind of stuff, is that, you know, it's just fascinating how intertwined our modern history is with the, you know, history of 200 years ago. And to know that we have developed technologies since then that have launched us further into the future than we ever thought. We, you know, reached the moon and all that kind of thing. But it all came down to the guy at the anvil face at some point. And as everyone is keen to remind me, I have said many times that the face of the modern world came off the face of the anvil. And I still stand by it, and I will always stand by that statement. And so this is kind of the thing that you get into, is the discovering the processes by which we developed industrialization of making. And this was just for swords. Like, we're not talking about the gun barrels that they had to make for Brown Bess muskets. We're not talking about the cannons and stuff like that they were trying to make, which I really want to do a segment. Let me know if you want me to get into cannon construction from that period. I know it's not specifically blacksmithing related, maybe. Like, there is some blacksmithing related stuff, but there's some really interesting topics around cannon construction, specifically Dutch and French cannon construction from around the 1617 and 1800s, that I would be incredibly passionate to talk about. So anyway, yeah, so that is the story of the patternization of British swords. Now, obviously, anyone who's familiar with the Napoleonic era will know that the 1796 light cavalry saber was not the only saber being used. There were a million other patterns of sword at the time, because, like I said, 1788 was the start of the patterning process, but 1796 is when patterning became the main thing. Right? They didn't have exceptions anymore. It was, everything was patterned. And so that's when you had the 1796 heavy cavalry trooper's sword. And then you had the 1796 infantry officer's sword, and you had the 1796 sawback Pioneer's Sword. And that's another favorite of mine, which I would love to talk about. but either way, at the end of the day, all of it came back to wanting to create a standardized form of sword that would still meet the rigors of combat. And this is why, like, I love the idea of doing the cleft weld wrought iron tangs, which is something I want to do on a build that I do in the future. I want to make a 1796 light cavalry saber, or maybe a heavy cavalry sword, with the traditional construction. And this construction, don't get me wrong, was still being used in like 1875. A lot of the Wilkinson sword three bar hilts that were used in 1845, 1821, all those kind of times, were still wrought iron tang with either shear steel or crucible steel blade. When I say crucible steel, I'm not talking woots. I'm talking like the standard homogenized steel that we now use today, or a similar kind of vein. But yeah, I think I've ranted long enough and I've gone on a million tangents, but hopefully that was enjoyable and somewhat followable. I do get carried away. But with that being said, we are reaching the end of the episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I know it was just me, and I sound a little bit gravelly because of the cold that I've got, and I know you missed Zach's laughing voice, but he will be back next week with maybe an awesome guest, so keep tuned for that one. If you want to ask us more questions and let us know whether or not you want me to rant about cannons for 20 minutes, you can send us an email to ask.forgecast@gmail.com, or you can contact us on Instagram at the.forgecast. You can find Zach at Laughing Fish Forge on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok, and I believe he's starting to expand into other realms. He's now on Threads, which so am I. We drank the Kool-Aid. Anyway, follow him over there, and if you want to find me, I am Sam Towns Bladesmith, and you can find me on YouTube, Patreon, Redbubble, Instagram, Etsy, Patreon, all the places, you know, they're linked in my Instagram bio, or you can find me at the_kitchen_sink on TikTok, and you can now find me on Threads, which, you know, like, I never thought I'd be there, but here we are, so I hope you all have a fantastic week. Don't do anything we wouldn't do. And if you do, make sure to film it. See you next time.